the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Let's read together from Psalm 23, shall we? In the Old Testament. Paul is right, this is a great gift tonight to have to speak about. Fantastic stuff. Psalm 23, we probably know it, many of us, off by heart, but let's read it anyway because there's always more in it. The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. Oh, by the way, it's 533, the page number, but then you knew that, didn't you? You're serious people who come to the evening service, therefore you know these things. Seriously, actually, I worry about how often we give out page numbers, because I think the habit of knowing what order the books of the Bible are in is disappearing, and that's not good. If you've never learned them, learn them. There are little songs on YouTube and all kinds of things that teach Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And, you know, I teach people in Austria to do that at the start of their Old Testament introduction course. And when I go back 6 months later, they all say, "Thank you so much. I can't get that stupid song out of my head." But at least the contents page of my Bible is not nearly so well thumbed as it used to be. And if you have to look at the contents page all the time, you are never going to be a serious Bible reader. So anyway, that's got nothing to do with what we're supposed to be talking about. Page 533, Psalm 23. Here we go. The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That's what we're looking at tonight. Marie's already mentioned the program card, and on the program card you'll see that there are five talks in this series, five psalms we're going to look at. There were 150 to pick from, and we've got these five. Tonight is called All About the Shepherd, and that's based on the words we've just read. Next week, James will be talking about the city of God from Psalm 48. Always intrigued me when I was a teenager. You know, we used to sing a little song about, "Great is our God and greatly to be praised." You remember that one? If you do, you're older than you look. But it always ends, it ends with, "Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king." And I always used to think, why is there a psalm in the Bible that sounds like an Israeli tourist agency message? But if you want to find out about the sides of the north, James will tell you next week. Then on the 11th of August, we've got Psalm 62, and Nick is talking about peace for our souls. Psalm 62 is a psalm that wrestles with God's providence, with evil in the world, with how you fit it all together, and comes to some conclusions that I think Nick is going to help us with. Then the fourth one, Psalm 127, Adrian Bailey, and this is the one that talks about, "Unless the Lord builds a house, they labor in vain that build it." Different kind of psalm, a psalm right from the middle of the songs of ascents, the little songs that people sang as they went up to the temple for celebrations and services. So a psalm with a different kind of purpose, and another example of the variety that you get in the 150 psalms in the Bible. Final one is Psalm 139. You've got to put that in the list somewhere, haven't you? And Sans will be helping us with this fantastic psalm about the greatness of God and how well he knows us, has known us since before we were born. It's a tremendous, tremendous way to end the series. So come to as many as you can. I mean, you can always cancel your summer holiday or whatever. But actually, all of these are designed to be standalone as well. So if you can only get to a few, you're not going to miss the series. That's the way it's going to go. So who wrote these psalms? Well, of the five that we're looking at, David wrote Psalm 23. The sons of Korah wrote Psalm 48. And no doubt you'll hear about them next time. David wrote Psalm 62. Solomon, who only wrote two psalms, actually, wrote 127. And the final one is David again. And that's just about right, because David wrote a lot of the psalms in the present collection that we've got. So it's good that his name's represented quite a bit. And we're looking at the first of the three psalms we're going to look at that he wrote here tonight. How do you divide it up? How do you make sense of it? The trouble is we're so familiar with it, aren't we, that it's difficult to actually analyze it into parts. But I think there are really three things that this psalm tries to give you. One is, it's a guarantee of God's endless supply to meet our needs. That's the first few verses. Then it moves into another section where it's talking really about the endless security that God provides. Walking through the valley of the shadow of death, you'll fear no evil because you're safe. He's with you. He's not going to let you go. And then the third part at the end talks about the endless surprises, it seems to me, that God gives us. Preparing a table in face of my enemies, making my cup not just full up but overflowing. There's some bizarre little pictures in there. And I think it's there to say God isn't finished when he's met our needs. God has all kinds of things to surprise us with as well. You'll notice that in the first few verses, it's all about him. He meets my needs. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. And then it moves into, what's the effect of that on me? The security. And that's a section about me. I will fear no evil. And the focus comes on me instead. And then the third is looking outward to the world, to all of the things that can trouble you. And it's more about them. Preparing a table for me in the presence of my enemies. With all of the things that rush in on my life, where am I in all of this? Goodness and mercy are still following me all the days of my life. And whatever's happening out there, I'm okay. So that's what we're going to look at. I just want to look at these three things tonight. The guarantee, first of all, then, of endless supply. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. You know, in old-fashioned versions, it says, I shall not want. So is it present or is it future? Well, actually, the Hebrew could be either, and it really means both. Because I lack nothing now, I can be secure in tomorrow. Because the same God who's meeting my needs now and has given me everything I need is going to be meeting those needs tomorrow. I'm safe. So whether it's present or future, it doesn't matter. You're held in the hands of a God who is committed to meeting all of your needs unconditionally, forever. That's where that big word mercy at the end comes in. Goodness and mercy shall follow me. Except, of course, in this version, it's goodness and love. That word translated mercy or love is a Hebrew word chesed, which is one of the great Old Testament words. And theologians often say it means covenant faithfulness, which sounds a bit boring to me. But covenant faithfulness really means a love and a provision that comes from God because he's promised. And he's a God who's reliable. And because he's promised, he will never, ever, ever break his promise. And so endless supply. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. I never will lack anything. Doesn't mean I get everything I want. And we'll say a little bit more about that. But I get everything I need. God meets my needs, and he's covenanted to do that for the future. He makes me lie down in green pasture. Oh, well, first of all, the idea of the Lord being a shepherd, this is an unusual one. And, of course, the psalm being written by David, who was a working shepherd for some years, is significant because he knows what he's talking about. Commentators on this psalm often point out that it wasn't unusual for gods and kings in the ancient world to say, you know, I'm just like a shepherd to my people. Yes, I am. And this is Hammurabi, whose famous law code came along about 700, maybe 800 years before this psalm was written. And he says, I am the shepherd who brings well-being and abundant prosperity. My rule is just, so that the strong might not oppress the weak, and that even the orphan and the widow might be treated with justice. And that's quite a common statement in the ancient Near East. So in that way, to say the Lord is my shepherd is not saying anything new. But notice, Hammurabi doesn't say much about what a shepherd does. He doesn't talk about sheep. He doesn't talk about a shepherd's activities. This psalm does. So it's more realistic. It's an everyday kind of thing. And while it was a title that kings and gods claimed for themselves in the ancient world, I am a shepherd. My people think I'm a great shepherd. Nonetheless, it wasn't necessarily true. And the reason that Psalm 23 is such a popular psalm, the reason it's rung through the ages and Jews and Christians have read it and treasured it down through the centuries is because it works out what that actually means. What does it mean for God to be a shepherd? In actual fact, most of the gods of the ancient world were nothing like shepherds. This is Marduk, the god of the Babylonians. He became the king of the gods by killing his mother in a fight in which he tore her in half and made half of her body into the earth and half of her body into the sky and so on. And having done that, he went back to the other gods and said, right, I've got rid of mum. Now you've said I can be the head of the gods. And he said, yep, that's fine. He said, good, I've just written down a list of jobs for you to do. Here are your activities. And he said, wait a minute, Marduk, we are gods. We don't do any work. So he thought, what do I do now then? And so he created a range of people who would be slaves for their whole lives, who would do the will of the gods and would then die and perish miserably, and they would be of no account. And that, brothers and sisters, is where we came from. That's the start of the human race. Now, that does not sound like a God who is much of a shepherd to me. Or take the old Greek myth of Prometheus, a god himself, a titan, who found that Zeus and the Olympians were taking over the heavens, and Zeus was now the head of the gods. And Zeus said, ah, these humans, they're not much use, wipe them out. And Prometheus wouldn't do that. And he took fire and taught the human beings how to use it, because humans had no idea about that. He taught them all kinds of stuff to make them more worthy in the eyes of Zeus. And Zeus was so annoyed that, as you can see, he had him chained to a rock with an eagle picking bits off his flesh for a snack every so often. And that's what happens when you fall out with Zeus, apparently. And Zeus didn't want human beings to survive. A god who is a shepherd? Don't think so. And yet David is so particular, isn't he? He's so detailed in what he says this God actually does. There are three things in that first section. First of all, nourishment. He makes me lie down in green pastures. Literally in Hebrew, green pastures means pastures of grass or fields of grass. The word green doesn't really appear. But, you know, there aren't many fields in some parts of Jerusalem, some parts of Israel, certainly not the parts north of Jerusalem where David was a shepherd for a while. There are some Israeli sheep looking for pasture. And as you can see, the land's pretty dark and barren. And you get some places where grass grows and some where it doesn't. It all depends on the west wind, apparently, and how it brings the moisture of the evening up against the rocks. And you get grass growing in funny, straggly little bits. So one of the main jobs for a shepherd is to find the green bits, the pastures where people can be fed. And that's the first thing that David says about his God. He leads me, he makes me lie down in green pastures. He doesn't just lead me through them, but he gives me the nourishment I need. And says, lie down here, take your fill, eat all you can. Christians are supposed to be growing people, aren't they? The New Testament's full of pictures about that. We're babies who need to grow up to maturity. We're branches in a vine that need to produce fruit. We are stones being built into a temple which is rising to be a holy temple in the Lord. We're growing people. A static Christian is not something the New Testament talks about at all. And to grow, you need nourishment. What David's saying here is God's giving us everything we want if we'll just have it. I mean, you can take a sheep to lie down in green pastures, but you can't make it nibble if it doesn't want to. But God supplies everything we need for our growth, for our life, for holiness. It's all there for us, constantly, nourishment. But we don't just need to be nourished. We also need to be refreshed from time to time, don't we? And he leads me beside still waters. Yeah, not just waters, but still waters. Why? Because sheep get frightened when water is splashing about the place and it's roaring and making a noise and things like that. Sheep are basically silly creatures, aren't they? And they can be scared away from what would bless them and refresh them if it's not quiet enough. But still waters, oh, they'll go and stand in it and drink it at the same time. They love it. And so he leads me by still waters. He takes me to where the waters are still, where I can appreciate how he wants me to be refreshed. And so he's feeding me and building me up. He's refreshing me with water from time to time. And all of that is part of the process. What else does he supply? Well, the other thing, it seems, in this section is right paths, guidance. You see, it'd be possible to be well fed and growing comfortably and refreshed and yet wandering off in the wrong direction. But he leads me in the right paths. And that's what the translation says. But of course, the traditional version of Psalm 23 says, he leads me in paths of righteousness. And that's absolutely right as well. The word in Hebrew is the word that's used for righteousness in the Old Testament. So it's not just the right path. No, come on, sheep, this way, not that way. It's also paths of righteousness. God has a plan for your life of mine and mine that includes being righteous. Living in a way that shows the rest of the world this is how it's supposed to be. And we have a shepherd who guides us into those paths. And righteousness in the Old Testament has all sorts of dimensions. Great that we were praying about Boris Johnson and Brexit and all that sort of stuff earlier, because that part of our life is part of it as well. John Wesley used to say, there is no holiness without social holiness. And it's not just a matter of, you know, paying your taxes on time and not telling lies and being nice to your next door neighbor and putting out their dustbin to be helpful to them. It's a matter of the impact your whole life has on the world in which you live. Wesley said, you know, if he made a fortune from the royalties on his sermons, which were published in his lifetime, but he said, it's not mine. I've got to give it away. He said, write me down as a thief and a liar if when I die, I have above £20 in my pocket. When John Wesley died, he left £17. The rest had gone to help people to live righteously. So God is a God of endless supply. But he's more than that as well. He's a God of endless security. Now the psalm wheels around and says, okay, if God's giving me all this stuff to keep me going all the time, meeting my needs, leading me on, challenging me, shaping my life, how does that mean I respond? And David's response is, even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Darkest valley is a bit of a come down, isn't it, from the old traditional, or the valley of the shadow of death, which it says in the small print in the bottom. And actually, it can be either. Sometimes in the Old Testament, this phrase is just used for dark valleys. But it actually, in Hebrew, sorry, I'm quoting a lot of Hebrew tonight, but it was written in Hebrew. In Hebrew, the phrase is actually, even though I walk through the death shadow valley. So those words are all in there. And I'm sure David had that in mind. He's maybe just talking about the different kinds of dark valleys we pass through in life. Because it's not always death, is it? There's all kinds of brokenheartedness. And we go through those valleys, sometimes very unexpectedly indeed. Death can be one of the worst. It's not the only one. And so I think this section is saying three things to us. First of all, that the darkest valley is a possibility. And I think part of the value of this psalm is that it's realistic about life. It's not just saying, isn't it fantastic? Belonging to Jesus. God gives us everything we need. It all comes from him. It recognizes too, we're going to pass through some pretty dark valleys. It's going to happen. And it can happen to Christians just as well as non-Christians. I don't know if you know who this is. You may well have been praying for her. This is Leah Shabiru. A little girl who at the age of 15 was abducted along with 110 other schoolgirls from Dapchi in Nigeria, where she was at school, by Boko Haram, the militants, in February 2018. And some months later, 110 of them came back. They were set free by Boko Haram. Many of them were Muslim girls already. Others of them had recanted their Christian faith and said they were Muslims. They'd said the Shahada just to be allowed to go free. And Leah was the one girl who surprised everybody by saying, no, I'm a Christian. I am not denying Jesus for anything. And so they let the others go, but they kept her in captivity, not knowing what they would do with her, just working on her. And for the last year, her mother has been in pieces waiting for Leah to be released and come home. And just this week, on the internet, news came out that Leah may very well be dead. The girl in the picture there is an aid worker, a Nigerian aid worker, who has also been captured more recently by Boko Haram. And they've released a video in which she's saying, please get me away, set me free, because they've already killed Leah, they've already killed Alice. When those words, they've already killed Leah, were heard in Nigeria, shockwaves went through the country. So many people have been thinking and praying for her. And if you haven't heard about her before, pray for her family now. Nobody knows if it's true or not, if this is just Boko Haram bringing extra psychological pressure. But that girl at age 16 stood out for her faith in Jesus Christ in a way that may well have cost her her life. And nobody says being a sheep with a great shepherd is always going to be fun. The darkest valley is a possibility. But second, destruction is not. Though I walk through the dark valley, I will fear no evil. There's nothing that can touch me. Jesus said, don't fear them that can kill the body. Fear rather the one who's able to kill the soul. Whatever happens to Christians, whether they live or die, they're held safe in the hands of someone who will not let them down. And so the valley is possible, destruction is not. I will fear no evil, says David. Why? Well, because God's presence is constant. You are with me. And David says there are two things that you carry that comfort me, that keep me going, that give me the strength and resilience to keep going. There's your rod and there's your staff. Now, that might be just be one thing. There's a medieval Jewish commentary on this psalm that says, you know, the shepherd had one implement. You don't want to carry lots of tools around you, you know, like a Dyson toolkit or something. If you're a shepherd, you've got to walk through the countryside all day. So you take one stick, and one end of it is a rod, which means you use it, first of all, for sorting out snakes. You poke it into holes to see if there are snakes that are going to poison your sheep. And second, for keeping the sheep in order. Not that way. Come back this way. Come, you just come here. And it's actually quite a light rod. It's the same word that's used in the famous verse, spare the rod and spoil the child. So it's a very, very light rod that's in view there. But the other end of it is a staff. And the staff is what you lean on. It's what gives you support. It will get you out of problems. And the two things are there. God's presence involves both the discipline that we need and also the support that we need. And those two things are there, aren't they? And David says, I can be comforted by both of those things because I know I need those two things, and I'm so glad. I've got a God who cares enough about me to bring discipline into my life and get me back in the right way when I'm drifting off. He doesn't just stand there and say, oh dear, look, he's doing it again. Oh well, I've told him once, I'm not going to tell him again. No, he gets involved. The rod comes into our life. Nobody chastens a son he doesn't love, says the New Testament. If we are chastened by God, if we're put under discipline by God, it's for our good. It's because he cares for us. But it's not just the rod. The staff is there to support us as well. And through the difficult times, the staff of God's presence and God's authority takes us on through all the problems we've got. So the guarantee of endless security. And this third bit, the guarantee of endless surprises. Why do I say that? Well, partly because you get lots of surprising little pictures appearing at the end of the psalm, don't you? And nobody's quite sure how to fit them all together. When it says, for example, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Clearly, he's stopped talking about sheep at this point. Nobody sets a table for sheep. You know, chimpanzees might just manage a chimpanzee's tea party, but can you imagine sheep coming around for supper? Don't think so. So we're talking about humans here. Now, how do you prepare a table in face of the enemies? Some commentators say, this is something that was sometimes done before a king went into battle. You know, when his forces were lined up here and the enemy were lined up there, the night before the battle, he would have his courtiers lay out a banquet in front of the battle lines, and he would sit there and feast. It's a way of bringing intimidation to the other side. Whoa, look at that lot. They're having a party over there. They must be pretty confident about tomorrow. Maybe we'd better not fight after all. Well, that's possible. I don't know. I'm skeptical. Other commentators say, no, this is what happens after the battle. After you've won the battle, then in the face of the enemies who are all in chains and being led off into somewhere or other, then you prepare a table and you feast. We won the battle, you guys lost. Hey. Well, I don't know if you have to get that specific about it. David certainly isn't very clear, is he? I think it's more just the pictures are interesting. You prepare a table in front of my enemies. When I've got enemies who are trying to tear me down, you don't just defend me from them. You actually spread a feast in front of me. That's bizarre, isn't it? The table spreading. You'd expect David to say, in the presence of my enemies, you stand up for me, you sort them out, you shield me, you guard me. But God does more than that. He surprises us. He brings good things into the midst of those tricky situations. He doesn't always take the enemies away. Sometimes the enemies hang around in our lives for a very long time, don't they? Not necessarily human enemies. Sometimes forces are working against us. Sometimes things that, all kinds of different things can be up against us, can't they? Pressures that come into our lives. And in the midst of those things, while all of that's still going on, God blesses us with something incredible. That's what the New Testament says about Jesus' peace, doesn't it? Do you remember how Jesus says towards the end of his life, peace I give to you, my peace I leave with you. Not such as the world gives, I'm leaving with you. Here's my parting gift to you guys, my peace. You've walked around with me for 3 years. You've seen me under pressure. You've seen me battered. You've seen me having nowhere to sleep at night. You've seen people crowding around me, trying to trip me up, looking for a miracle, trying to get anything they can out of me, trying to get me to make legal decisions about who should divide the fortune, all that sort of stuff. You've seen how pressurized I have been for 3 years. And you know, I've lived in a pool of peace. Now, that's the peace I'm leaving with you. A peace that goes through pressures. A peace that passes understanding, as Paul puts it in Philippians, because, you know, your understanding can't comprehend. I'm feeling peaceful. I'm feeling okay. I should be panicking. Why am I not panicking? And the answer is because the peace of God, says Paul, builds a wall around your hearts and minds. The peace of God will keep your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. That word keep in that verse means will build a garrison around. We are living in God's peace in the midst of an enemy situation. And God makes that happen. It's one of the surprises. But there are two other words that are used as well, aren't there? I've got to finish in a minute. The first one is oil. You anoint my head with oil. He's keeping the party image going here. He's talked about having this banquet spread before you. And now he says, you anoint my head with oil. That, again, is something you would do when it's party time. There's a great verse in Ecclesiastes which basically says, for Christians, life should be a party. What it says is, always be dressed in white. Not many people living up to that one tonight. And always let your head be anointed with oil. What does that mean? Well, in those days, in that country, the only time you would ever wear white clothes was when you were on your way to a celebration. Because it was a rural country. If you went to get the eggs out of the hen house or muck out the pigsty or something wearing white clothes, they wouldn't be white by the time you came back into the house. So somebody wearing white was on his way to something festive. And Ecclesiastes says, always be dressed in white. Always make life a party. And let your head be always anointed with oil. Again, that was something you did at a party. It was something you did to pick out somebody and make them special and unique. Do you remember Jesus having that costly ointment broken over his head? That was the kind of thing you sometimes did to say to somebody, you are unique, you are special. And God surprises us in that way too, doesn't he? He anoints our head with oil. Just when we're feeling broken, worthless, at the bottom of the heap, God comes along and says, you're special, you're unique. And I will show you in one more way just how much you matter to me. So there's a table, there's the oil, and the third, the cup. God's not very good at judging quantities, is he? He doesn't fill it up. He overfills it. And Christians all over the world, down through the centuries, have testified to the fact that when God blesses your life, he doesn't give you just what you need and no more. He's laughably generous. God loves a cheerful giver because he is a cheerful giver himself. And he just overfills everything. Do you remember how the old hymn goes? His love has no limit. His grace has no boundary. Oh, no, his grace has no boundary known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. That's the way it works, isn't it? A God who guarantees surprises. So, we reach the end of the psalm. What does all of this mean to you? Endless supply, endless security, endless surprises. What does it produce? Two more things I'll say at the end of the psalm, and then we're done. The first of those is this. We are pursued by goodness and mercy. You know, some people who want to see sheep all over this psalm have come up with the idea that goodness and mercy are like the sheep dogs, you know, that chase along after the sheep. And I used to think, what a mawkish image. That is so sentimental. But actually, there's something in it. Because that word, your goodness and love will follow me, well, that word follow is the word that's regularly used right through the Old Testament for pursuing somebody, chasing after them. It happens when, you know, somebody with a spear in his hand, I'm going to kill you. That's not that that's what goodness and mercy do, but it means chasing after somebody because you want to catch them. It doesn't mean just tagging along behind them. So whether it's like sheepdogs or whatever, goodness and mercy, those two things. The goodness means just all of the good things that God gives you with persecutions in this present life. All of the stuff that arrives to bless your life. That will pursue you as long as you live. You will go through times when you think, I haven't got very much. I've never achieved very much. I'm worried about the future. But goodness will still be pursuing you even when you feel like that. We need to hold on to it and remember it. And then there's mercy. Chesed, covenant faithfulness. We've talked about it already. God's firm promise that he will do good to you as long as you live. And the acts of goodness and the promise of love will pursue you to the end of your days. And on your very dying day, they will still be there right at your heels. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. What's that talking about? Well, lots of the Psalms, if you read them through, talk about the house of the Lord, don't they? Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? Who can go into his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart. And something in David clearly burned to go into God's presence. And the Psalms talk about it again and again. Better be a doorkeeper in the house of the Lord and all that sort of stuff. just to be in the presence of God. Some of the songs of the ascents talk about the people who serve overnight in the temple and say, bless the Lord, you servants of the Lord. You've got the privilege of being there in God's presence all night. And yet David's talking about something different here, isn't he? He's not talking about going to the physical building in Jerusalem. He's talking about God's temple being there with him. I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. How does that actually work? Well, David's saying it's possible for this God, who is the God of love, who pursues us through our lives, the God who feeds us and leads us and guides us, that God to be as close to us as if we were living in his temple with him day by day. And this kind of personal relationship with God lies at the heart of the whole thing that David's talking about here. No wonder down through the centuries, this kind of relationship with God is what people have seen the possibility of as they've read Psalm 23. One of the simplest psalms in some ways in the book, isn't it? But it goes deep. I told somebody a story this morning, and Anthea said, I'm glad you didn't use that in the service because it's such a morbid story. I don't think it's morbid at all, but I'm going to finish with it and let you judge. As some of you know, my father used to work amongst prisoners in Scotland. And one lad came through the detention centre where he was once, called John. And John had a pretty sad story. He was, for a start, the son of incest. A father and daughter had this child and were so ashamed of what they'd done, they just abandoned him. He spent his whole life growing up in children's homes. Because of the situation of his birth, he was also mentally disabled. He was not very bright. He didn't look physically attractive at all. And lots of people just didn't want to know him. But you know what? Despite the fact he was pretty slow, in that detention centre, John began to understand that this life of crime he'd got himself involved in was the wrong way to go. And that there was a shepherd who loved him and wanted to guide his life. And he couldn't read much of the Bible. He couldn't read. He was trying to do Bible correspondence courses and he wasn't very good at them. He got some of the lowest marks we've ever had for those courses. But my father just taught him Psalm 23 and said, listen, the Lord is my shepherd. Just think about that, John, when you get under pressure. The Lord, he's the only one. The Lord, he's the boss, he's God. The Lord is, he really exists. The Lord is my, not everybody's, but yours, shepherd. And think about that word too. And John, when he was released from detention centre, started to live out a completely new life. Happy, contented, knowing the Lord as his shepherd. Until one day his life ended when he was employed as a gardener on a big estate. And one day, a hot day like this, he went into the garage needing a drink and picked up a bottle of what he thought was lemonade. It was paraquat weed killer. And he died in agony the same night. And somebody rang my father and told him, and he went down to see what had happened. And he said, can you tell me about the circumstances? He said, yeah, we understand what happened. It's all very straightforward. There's only one thing that we don't understand. And my father said, what's that? He said, well, when he died,